Welcome back to Hakuna Lorcana, a worry-free podcast about the Disney stories we love and the Lorcana cards they inspire. I'm Caleb.
And I'm Katie. Today, we are talking about Atlantis, the 2001 movie where we joined a ragtag group of misfits as we journeyed miles under the ocean to the lost empire of Atlantis. But before we dive into the lore, Caleb, how is your weekly lore count?
I'll say my lore is at an 8, but my ink, Katie, is at a 12 because I am ramping up for set championships. Let me tell you what.
I like that. A new dimension.
Yeah, exactly. So I know this episode is dropping in the middle of set championships, going into like the last weekend of set championships. So I'm hoping that everybody has having some success. But, you know, we're recording this on the precipice of set championships. And I couldn't be more excited. It's going to be really fun. I think my anxiety level has come down. I'm feeling good about the deck/decks that I'm going to run. So... Yeah, it's feeling good.
Is it down to one or you have two?
Yeah.
You don't have to tell us because that's secret. That's proprietary. Yeah,
so
I've let the people know.
You know, it's out in the open that I'm a Ruby Sapphire player. I'm digging it. But you know, I will be going into a few different places that I don't know the meta. I don't know the people that are necessarily there. I might know a handful of people, but not everybody. So I'm also I also have like a deck list and the cards ready for a Ruby Amethyst deck that, you know, depending upon the room, who might be there, I'll just, you know, take some of my Ruby cards out of my Ruby Sapphire deck and then throw it into the Ruby Amethyst deck and then run that. Cause that's has, you know, nothing super favored, but nothing really unfavored. Whereas with Ruby Sapphire, if I feel like I might go up against a few aggro decks or something, I'm kind of out of luck at that point. So, you know, like this coming weekend, in the first weekend, we're doing two in Pueblo, and I'm going to run Ruby Sapphire at one and then Ruby Amethyst at the other, and then just kind of see from there how it feels.
I feel less creative because I'm like, well, my backup deck is Ruby Amethyst, but I think it's the most predictable, stable deck. Like that deck, it's in the middle every time, and so that can be really good, it can be really disappointing, but it's nice to have a deck where I'm like, I'm not, that deck doesn't stress me out. But I think some of the other decks, like Steel Song, it stresses me out. There's times it goes good and there's times it makes me feel bad.
So that's the thought there. You know, we got to play in a draft on Friday that was super fun. This was a 1-1-2 draft, so we got one first chapter pack, one Floodborne pack, and then two Inklands packs. And I actually liked that format a lot more than I thought I was going to. I just like knowing all 204 cards that I could be going up against or I could be pulling from these packs. So having expanding the set of cards that could be played, you know, by triple, like it's 612 cards now that could be played. It's a little much, but I liked it more than I did. I still think I prefer like single set draft or sealed, you know, but it was still a really good time. I felt like I played pretty well, and I pulled an enchanted Bell's House from my prize packs. So that was pretty fun.
That is exciting. I downplayed it cause I was a little jealous. I was like, Bell's House, but that's every enchanted.
Yeah.
And that one is pretty. I think it's a pretty,
it is pretty. It's one of those where you're like, oh, you're not really playable, but you are awesome. Like you look great. So I like that. So maybe my, you know, if I'm pulling an enchanted, maybe my lore's at like a 10 or a 12, not an 8, you know?
Exactly. You yeah. Know. That pumps those numbers for sure.
Yeah. Katie, what about you? Where's your lore count at this week?
Yeah, I mean, this has been a good week. So I'd say 15 out of 20.
Okay.
The tournament, the one that you were talking about, we didn't talk about this in our prepping for the set championship episode, but it's something to note that pairings can be great, but they can also break your heart. Because I had pairings where you'll hear the term matching down or pairing down, and I got paired down. And you might say, what does that mean?
Yeah.
Well, If you got odd numbers, then sometimes you with your, I had a 2-1 record. I'd won two, lost one. So they run out of people with my score to pair me with. So they pair you down to a person with a 1-2
record. Yeah. Okay.
So you might, and So the thought process is, well, that's great because now I'm going to I win probably because they're doing worse than me and I'm better. But the way melee works and the way a lot of systems work is your placement at the end is based on who you beat and also who you lost against. Yeah. So the fact that I beat someone with a low record mean I had the same record as Kayla, but you were third and I was seventh. So it was a heartbreaker. But
tiebreakers, man. They'll get you.
I know. It's hard not. Yeah. And it's in bigger tournaments, it's not as much of a thing because, you know, I think in some of these tournaments coming up, there'll be more. We only had 4 rounds and there's probably gonna be 5 or 6. Yeah. I don't know. But so if you ever hear someone be like, I paired down, it's a bummer. Getting buys can be a bummer because you're like, oh, I don't get to play. But that can also, I don't know. So we can do a whole episode on my grievances. But other than that,
yeah,
it was still fun. And my dad was there.
Yeah.
So
I got to meet your dad. That was awesome.
I know. It was so fun. I got to, I made my dad become a Lurkana player forcibly because he is a collector by nature and he loves Disney like I do. So I was like, you have
That's
to
awesome.
Play. And he loves games. So yeah, he came and did the draft with us and so did my husband, which was exciting. I felt like, I was like, wait, these are all my friends. So yeah, that was great. It was great to have them there. I think if you have family, bring them to League.
Yeah, just bring them
it's
along.
It's so much fun. So I know. And so, well, the downside is I brought them on it was a double feature night. And you might say, not Caleb's double feature. Oh, okay. Double feature as there was a Magic tournament and a Lurkana tournament.
Yeah, that was a little stressful.
That was a little bananas. It was.
Yeah.
So that, my dad definitely made like, oh, eyes when we walked in. And I didn't blame him because I had the same face because that was more people than I was ready for.
Pretty much.
It was fun. It all worked out.
Every other set release for Magic that we've had, I'm pretty sure they've canceled League, right? Like they've kind of let Magic have their Friday night thing. And then every other Friday, Lurkana gets to play at the same time as Magic. And they didn't cancel it this time for the set release. It was like a 24-person Lurkana draft and then like a 30-person Magic draft happening at the same time in a room that already tends to get sweaty in the first place. So,
Yeah, I would like to put a little manifestation to the universe that I hope Lurkana follows Magic the Gathering's pre-release lifestyle because they get these cute little boxes with little trinkets and packs and like a dice and it's adorable and I would like that, please.
Yeah,
so
goodie bags.
Do that.
Prize packs.
Yes.
Stuff like that, you know?
I know.
It feels good.
It's like a promo everyone gets, but I don't care. I want it. If it's shiny, people who weren't there don't get it. So, so I was looking at the Magic Kids a little jealous. I was like, oh, they got cooler stuff. But, you know, what can you do? One day we'll get there.
Yeah. You know, we do get to have Belle and Simba on our cards, and they don't. So.
Yeah. Yeah, right. They have like what? Snakes, gargoyles? I don't know.
I don't know.
Not
what,
cool stuff.
I don't know
we
what's
have snakes
on their
and
card,
gargoyles, but they're different.
Anyways.
Yeah. Magic, a gathering of magical objects.
Yeah. It's just magic on the cards. I don't know if that's literal, though. That's kind of cool. Anyways.
Either way.
So, as Katie mentioned before, we are talking about Atlantis today. So, Katie, tell me about your background with Atlantis.
So, I do like to try to work in my background with anime growing up. And so this one, it is relevant. So when I was little, there was this anime that came out in the early 90s called Nadia, the Secret of Blue Waters. And it was very Jules Verne-y. There was like this girl from a lost continent or something. I was very young and I couldn't read much, and it was subtitled. But either way, I got the vibes that there were people, submarines, adventure. I loved it. And my dad was like, well, if you like that, this is based on Jules Verne. So then the Jules Verne mild obsession started, and you might think I was a gifted child, but it was like technically those books, I don't know if you ever saw them, where they were like the abridged children's version of like this classic, and it was like
– I am unfamiliar.
You know,
I'm utterly
novel.
Unfamiliar, so –
Yeah, and I liked him because I'm like, look how smart I am. But really, it was like big font, really boiled down. But either way, I was like, I think it was Journey to the Center of the Earth, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, and Around the World in 80 Days. Those three were like the big three.
Yeah.
So long story short, I was a big fan of that time frame. So then when Disney was like, oh, guess what? It's our turn. I was absolutely thrilled.
Yeah.
So yeah, this has been a movie that has been a favorite since I saw it. It's been one of those like on the shelf. This isn't going to get removed as a favorite. It's always going to be in the top at least five probably for me.
Yeah.
What about totally. You?
Well, so this is another movie that I kind of have, I don't know. I'm a person that likes to categorize things and group things together. And so there are four Disney movies that came out within a 2-year span: Emperor's New Groove, Lilo and Stitch, Treasure Planet, and Atlantis. And I just group those four movies together. And even though there is, you know, a lot of difference between things in the animation and everything like that, I still get like similar feelings, although the Venn diagram isn't completely collapsed, you know, like they do have their distinct differences from each other. And of those four movies, I always thought of Atlantis as like the serious movie. You know, there's like really goofy parts about Emperor's New Groove and even like Lilo and Stitch and stuff like that, but Atlantis is like the serious movie. There's comedic relief, obviously, like throughout Atlantis. It's still a children's movie. There are moments to laugh, but the plot is like very intense and like grounded and like literally earthy. Like I know they're going to the middle of the earth, but also it like just feels earthy. And you know, Emperor's New Groove like asks you to like suspend your disbelief, like turning into a bunch of different animals and all this kind of stuff. But in Atlantis, it's like almost a very literal plot where the only like jump that you have to make is like, what if Atlantis was real? You know, like that's like, let's just go with that. Let's pretend that it like it's discovered. And then like, let's go on this literal adventure to go find it and see what it's like. Right. And so there are a lot of things that are very unique about Atlantis that I feel like Disney hadn't done before and hasn't really done since. And as a kid, I could kind of feel that. I couldn't really put words to it like I can now, but I've always had this, like, it's felt like this very serious and like big movie to me.
It's good that you say that, because we mentioned that, or I think I mentioned it in Lion King, that there's certain movies you watch and you can tell it's different. You can tell your parents are paying a little bit more attention. You can tell it feels more mature. So yeah, it was like a more mature, refined Disney movies in some way. You felt like it was just something a little special, or at least I did. At least compared, to the other movies that came before it, which I can't wait. I can't wait to talk about the fun facts, because they talk about this exact thing.
Yeah, so like, let's get into that. So what are like the main details of the movie before we jump into those fun facts?
Well, I have a mini fun fact. Okay. The title of the film, I don't know how I didn't know this. I felt very silly, foolish last night. Huh. It's Atlantis, the Lost Empire.
Oh.
Don't know how I didn't realize there was a thingy after it.
Yeah.
But there is. It's on every movie poster. It's in the Wikipedia. I'm like, no, it's Atlantis. And that was all I needed. But it is the Lost Empire. Huh.
Okay.
So that's the first fun fact, is the name of the movie, which is we're off to a great start. But the film was released on June 15th, 2001. And it was directed by Gary Trousdale and Kirk Wise. Now, Trousdale and Wise previously worked together on the criminally underrated film Hunchback of Notre Dame. So I'm very curious that these two guys are like, Victor Hugo, Jules Verne, let's do it. The kids love this stuff.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
They were on something.
Yeah, they got that through somehow.
Yeah, they were exploring.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. They're like, next year, Les Mis, animated. So I don't know. I guess it's good someone stopped them. So notable voice actors in this one was obviously Michael J. Fox as Milo Thatch. Yeah. You also have James Garner as Commander Lyle Tiberius Rook, which is something I don't have fun saying, and we're going to have to say several more times in this podcast.
If you want to just choose one of the three names, you can. But up to you. If you're up for the Lyle. Challenge. Yeah.
Yeah, he's just Lyle from this point on. And then lastly, we had Leonard Nimoy, Spock himself, as King of Atlantis, which I thought was kind of fun. So, and the last little core piece is that the epic score. I say epic because it felt very like, going on an adventure with them. It's a good score. It was composed by James Newton Howard, and he worked on such films. They're better films than this, but I had to start with Space Jam because I was like, well, that's the first one I'll leave with. He scored Space Jam. And then also some amazing sweeping composing works of The Hunger Games, The Dark Knight, Ooh, Batman Begins.
So that's a good list.
He's done some.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's done. He has credentials, and you can tell because I think the soundtrack, it's got some heft to it. It's definitely one of my more favorite adventure soundtracks.
Yeah. I just love it when these composers who are doing like big budget drama movies like The Dark Knight are also doing animated Disney movies. You know, there's, it just brings like that dignity to the craft that is animated film. And it's just, you know, a score of a movie just brings it all together. And so, yeah, this is another one that is, it is that sweeping, like, let's go on an adventure, like, let's do something insane. And the music is going to carry you along the way just as much as the submarine is, you know.
Yeah, and I think that's one of my favorite parts of this podcast so far is I think I took for granted the composers of the score because I just always assumed someone did it. And now I'm like, wow, it makes sense. These people do great stuff.
Yeah, it contributes a lot.
I'm excited to learn about them.
Yep. So each week we like to highlight a little window into some lesser known facts about these films. So, Katie, what do you have for our three fun facts about Atlantis?
So I like to start my first fact with always kind of where did it come from? Mm-hmm. How did we get here? So as I mentioned before, this film draws heavily on the works of Jules Verne, specifically the 1870 novel 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Okay.
So the team that wrapped up on Hunchback, they're like, that was fun. We had fun. What's next? And they wanted to do a more adventure-y kind of film. And they used that novel as a starting point, but it also they used a problem they had with the novel. And what happens is in the 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea adventure, they just like drive past Atlantis. I haven't read the book. I read the abridged one when I was like seven. Yeah. So not an expert, but apparently they just like go, oh, there's Atlantis. And they like peace out. So they were very sad that there was this cool land and they're like, that important. We're going, that's not. We don't have time for that. So that was what their story was going to revolve around, the myth of Atlantis. Now, this was one – we're falling into that thing that happened again with Sword in the Stone where I'm like, it's a myth, right? It's a myth, right? This one, I'm 99% sure is a myth that started with Plato back in 400 BC. So, you know, that's like 2,400 years ago. So, you know,
that's a long time
people
ago.
Argue. They're like, well, maybe – yeah, maybe people are like, well, maybe he knew something that he forgot to tell us that this is real and it's not a story. But either way, it's a story probably.
Yeah.
So, and then as far as the theme of how they wanted it to feel, they were inspired by the Disney films of the 50s and the 60s that were live action.
Okay.
And I don't know if you ever stayed up too late and saw on the Disney Channel when they'd play like those really boring movies.
Oh yeah,
they were not great. They were great, but they were like not movies for me. So there was like the Swiss Family Robinson, Treasure Island. They're very inspired by that string of films.
Yeah.
And then also Raiders of the Lost Ark, which once you're like, oh yeah, obviously.
Classic.
So they're very inspired by those. So the next piece that they're inspired by, this is something that kind of I've never heard of. They were inspired by the works of Edgar Cayce. It could be Casey or Case. I'll say Casey.
Okay.
He was a man who he was born in the late 1800s. And in the early 1900s, he became very popular for his clairvoyant readings.
Hmm.
And one of the things he would say is he's like, I see Atlantis. I don't know how he would do it, but this is how I imagine. Go, I see Atlantis. And it was powered by a giant crystal. So, yeah, that crystal part is from a man who's like, yeah, I saw it, actually. I can see through time and space. And so
wow,
that guy helped inspire it. Because, yeah, that was something where I'm like, I don't know if that's from the book. But apparently, no, it was from this guy who could see through time.
Okay.
So they also kind of, speaking of the early 1900s, they like that turn of the century, that kind of steam-powered,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, the steampunk kind of.
Now they call it.
Like everything's brass and.
Yeah. Yeah. And so they liked how, I mean, the steam leaned into the punk when you got the combination of, you know, Milo's jalopy next to a flying fish.
Yeah.
So they liked that. So they set it in that time period to try to kind of juxtapose those two technologies.
Yeah.
So next we talk about the art. This is something also I found very interesting. It's very obvious watching it that this is an art style that you don't see before and after.
Mm-hmm.
Disney now kind of people will say their same face syndrome, where they'll say, like, you know, Anna and some other characters, not blinking of any other princess, but some of the characters now, Elsa and all the other prince, Mirabelle, they look like they could be from the same universe. This movie doesn't look like it's from other universes.
Oh, not at all.
So, and they did that because they worked with a comic book artist named Mike Mignola, and he is the creator of Hellboy. So if you look up his art, you can kind of see it. So Hellboy, I think, is a Dark Horse comic, so it's not Marvel or DC. And he helped create the distinctive character designs. Like, one of the things I noticed, their fingers are square. That's very unique.
Yeah, like the ends of their fingers.
Yeah, so he helped do the character designs, and he also helped with monsters, which obviously Hellboy and monsters kind of go, I'm assuming, go hand in hand. And he helped create a terrifying Leviathan that casually kills 150 people in the first 30 minutes.
Just casually, you know.
So, yeah, that happens in lots of
Disney. We recognize it for about 12 seconds and then move right along, you know.
Yeah, right. So at the heart, their goal for this film, they wanted to make a distinctly unique film from the other films that came out the previous decade, which is called the Disney Renaissance. So those are things like Little Mermaid and Aladdin. And so to wrap up this fun fact, they even wore shirts that say, Atlantis, fewer songs, more explosions.
Wow, that's bold.
Which is also a good, it's a good deck name too. I should have run a deck that's like fewer songs, more explosions. And it's just,
that would be a perfect deck.
That could
deck.
Be fun.
Oh, man. What deck would that be? That's got to be a ruby deck.
I don't know.
But a ruby steel.
Yeah.
Don't even... Well, I mean, steel's got all the songs.
Less songs, more explosions. Well, but you could have fewer. As long as it's like less songs than a steel song.
Yeah, it's less
then
songs than you normally run with steel. But you're running like Smash and Dragonfire, you know. You're just blowing stuff
more
up.
More explosions.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So I would like that shirt. If anybody on eBay comes across it.
Yeah, Atlantis. Fewer songs, more explosions. You know, I could get behind that from time to time. I'm never going to dog Disney movies, or Disney songs, rather, ever. But sometimes you want a movie that has fewer songs and more explosions. And Atlantis is right up that alley.
Although, fun caveat. So last night I was watching it, and I always blank out that Disney did this bizarro thing, and they might still do it. I don't think they do, but in the 90s and early 2000s, where no matter what the movie is, they're like, and here is a pop song that has nothing to do with the rest of it. And the one for Atlantis is especially egregious because I don't know who sings it. I don't know where it came from.
Are you talking about when
like,
they
here,
roll the credits?
Yeah.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Can we talk about that? The R&B songs that play at the end of like 80s and 90s animated movies is immaculate. Like, I would want to do an entire podcast episode just talking about those songs because there's like
a lot
of the time, if there are a lot of songs from a movie like Beauty and the Beast or something, you know, there's like the theatrical version, but then there's like, oh yeah, and then Elton John's version of Can You Feel the Love Tonight gets played during the credits or something like that, and those songs can go so hard. So I don't know.
Yeah,
that's a great
true.
Observation.
I mean, I listened to it last night. Couldn't tell you any details of that song, but I was like, okay, one song, and
it's like
not memorable.
The
no offense
only
to the
song that has lyrics in it in the whole movie. Yeah,
exactly.
So, well, one thing that you brought up that I wanted to touch on is the animation style. I think is really worth noting. Like, if that's something that has never necessarily stood out to you, as you've watched Atlantis, you know, if you rewatched it to listen to our show, like, kudos to you. If you haven't rewatched it quite yet, go back and rewatch it and just take note of like the faces of all the characters and their hands and their body shapes. You know, you brought up kind of the art style in Lilo and Stitch and how like Lilo is very round and this is like the exact opposite of that. Like, there's angles all over the place. Like, everything is so sharp. So it is quite a contrast.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's so interesting to know like everything about this movie, when we say it's different. Like, that was the intent.
Yeah.
That was exactly what they're trying to do, is be like, how can we make it different? And they did it. So,
yeah.
Now, fact number two.
Yes.
Now, while Atlantis, like I said, dates back to Pluto. No. While the tale of Atlantis dates back to Plato.
Yes.
Pluto's a different Disney character. the filmmakers didn't want to just say, okay, well, here's what the Greeks thought it looked like. Because, you know, that obviously in the movie, they're nowhere near Greece. So instead, they turned to other inspirations from around the world of ancient civilization. And one place they visited was the Mayan ruins, which I, this is humble brag time. In March, I went to Chichen Itza, which is where the Mayan ruins are. Oh. And you can definitely, you can tell. I might post some pictures on my story when this episode comes out, because I mean, there were times where like, yep, okay, that's definitely what I kind of saw there. So
yeah,
they're heavily inspired by those ruins. Now they also went to, I believe, like some Asian ruins. They went around the world because they wanted to kind of say, what could this culture be?
Yeah, yeah.
Side asterisk. Are they immortal? Did they go over that? Because they're like, oh yeah, Pluto, this happened. And then Milo comes and he's like, oh, she's like, she remembers Atlantis falling. And I'm like, did Atlantis fall very recently?
Like,
are you 2,000 years old?
The Atlanteans, you're wondering?
Yeah.
Yeah, they make Kida a reference to that. I think there's a reference to her dad makes a reference to like, you're only like 2,000 years old or something like that.
Okay.
So I don't know if they're immortal necessarily, but I'm pretty sure the heart of Atlantis means that like their lifespan is like, ours is not anywhere close to their lifespan.
Okay.
That's my thought. Right. That's
plot
the
hole covered. Because I was thinking last night, I'm like, wow, she looks really good for 2,400 years old. But so as why I'm 99% sure Atlantis is not real, so they also were 99% sure, so they had to get creative when they were creating the people and culture of Atlantis. Mm-hmm. And so a big part of the film is the language of the Atlanteans.
Yeah.
So Milo Thatch was enlisted in the journey because he was a linguist and an archaeologist. I know he was definitely a linguist.
Yeah.
And a translator. So the people who made the movie, the team, they wanted them to have conversations. They wanted it to sound real. So to do this, they turned to Mark Okrand.
Okay.
So Mark Okrand is a world-renowned linguist who specializes in Native American languages.
Hmm.
But the line item on his resume that got him hired for this film is he was a creator of a language spoke by the people of Klingon. So he invented Klingon. So he has two languages under his belt.
So there's like two Star Trek overlaps with Atlantis. Okay.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah. So that's a good point. So Leonard Nimoy spoke a language written by a guy that wrote Klingon. So there's, it's all coming together.
It's all coming together, as Kronk would say.
So Milo states in the film that it's a mother language. So a mother language is kind of like the top of that like tree where all the other languages descended.
Yeah.
So to do that, they used Indo-European word stocks and then built their own grammatical structure. And then they would kind of change things around if it sounded too much like another language. So, yeah. So there's at least one person on this earth who speaks both Klingon and Atlantean.
Huh. Is that you?
Yeah. Yeah. It's me. Surprise. So that's my third fun fact. The rest of this episode.
Yeah.
So I thought that was kind of interesting how much work they went into when they probably did, you know, four scenes that featured the language and it wasn't, they subtitled it so you don't even think about it.
Yeah.
So I was like, wow, that's a lot of work.
Like that's
something, a movie.
That's when you're like super invested into your world building where not only do you like have the backstory and everything figured out, but you actually have like the whole language and you have a written language, you have a spoken language and you have it all figured out. I mean, that's kind of crazy.
I know. That was impressive. And the fact that, yeah, they're like, listen, you make languages, you're making one for us. So to feed into the last fact, it gets a little sad. It gets sad from here because as we just discussed, obviously they're like building languages. They're like, Atlantis is going to be a big deal because look how much work we put into it. It was not a big deal.
No.
It was not. For those following up along at home who are going, I've never seen Atlantis. It's because it wasn't actually so successful. It wasn't a failure. I think it still made money, but it certainly wasn't a Disney success or whatever they would use as a metric for success. So their goal is they wanted to make a film that was away from Fantasyland towards Adventureland. So they were thinking, they were already like marketing it in their head. And so before the movie even came out, they were so confident that people were going to like it. They started all these projects. They're like, this is going to happen.
Okay.
And Shrek is to blame for this.
Oh, of course he is.
I know. So what happened is the 2001, I believe in April, Shrek came out and people wanted that kind of comedy. They wanted 3D animation. They wanted, you know, goofy Shrek humor.
Yeah.
So, and also the same time Atlantis came out, Lara Croft Tomb Raider, the one with Angelina Jolie, came out. So people are like, listen, I got Shrek, I got Lara Croft, I don't need Atlantis. So it wasn't successful. And as a result, I know it's kind of, this is, I don't like this part of the story, but either way. So as a result, several projects were shelved. So the first one is a spin-off animated TV series called Team Atlantis. So, you know, I think anybody who watched the movie can attest there's this wonderful array of characters that each get, you know, probably one conversation in the entire movie. Mm-hmm. And that was okay because they had a whole TV show ready where that team was going to go. They were going to explore other mythical locations. They were going to go to supernatural things. They were going to, you know, basically do an Atlantis in other places.
Wow. I want that.
Canceled. Not happening. Yeah, didn't happen. Although I did see last night there's a Milo's Return, and I kind of, maybe we can do a bonus episode on Milo's Return because maybe. I'm like, I don't know if I want to watch that.
Maybe we should. Yeah.
I don't know.
We could maybe do a bonus episode on just a bunch of sequels, you know, like straight to VHS sequels or something like that. Cause yeah, there's some things to be said.
Yeah. So that was the first thing that got the axe. The second one is around the time the movie was coming out. There was an attraction in Disneyland that many people probably know and loved from the olden times called 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Okay.
Jules Verne. He's here again. Now, that ride, I think it was perfect as is, but it was like a little dated. It was very, you know, it was an IP that not people, I mean, there's not a lot of kids who are like, I want to go to Jules Verne Land.
Yeah,
so essentially they were.
I remember going to Disneyland when I was a kid, and I remember going on It's a Small World because it's like, you know, that's like iconic Disneyland stuff. And I was kind of confused. I was like, this isn't like nearly as entertaining as a lot of the other rides here. And I could, and then I was like, oh yeah, that's because this ride was made like a long time ago. So.
Yeah, no. Although, fun fact, I'm abusing that term, but either way, I went to Disneyland by myself in December, and I rode It's a Small World four times that day.
Hey.
Something happened. I think it's because I'm in my 30s. I just want to sit on a boat ride and take in the sights.
Yeah.
I don't know what happened.
You just kind of want something to propel you forward at like 4 miles an hour for several minutes, and it's like, this feels nice.
It was enchanting.
Yeah.
It was. I was like, man, this is living.
Yeah.
So... Anyway, so Small World.
That's a rabbit trail.
So either way, the ride was getting old. They're like, we need to refurb it. And as you, anybody who's a theme park fan in the past three decades can say, they're trying to pack as much IP as possible. So they said, you know what would be great? Atlantis, a submarine. It's all coming together.
Yeah.
So much so that they were like, you can find drawings of a possible, like the what submarine would take you to Atlantis and you would get off the submarine and walk around Atlantis. So it was so close to being done that what happened is 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea went down for refurbishment, and they erected a sign that said Atlantis Expedition Imagineering Preparation Base.
Whoa.
And you can find a picture of it. So it was happening.
That close.
Someone probably had an Excel spreadsheet about it. I know, but the movie, Nobody liked it. I liked it. Me and my 10 friends liked it. So essentially they were like, whatever, we're not doing that. And it sat empty for a while. They didn't open that ride. If I might be wrong, but I think it was 2007. They opened with Nemo.
Of course.
Nemo and Friends, which is still cute. It's fine. But
can't deny Nemo.
Atlantis, so,
you know, it's like I can't deny Shrek.
It's cute.
Honestly,
it's fine.
I like Shrek. I like Nemo. I like all of these things. But why did they have to steamroll Atlantis? Come on. Like, there's enough room for everybody.
I know. Maybe not Shrek. Shrek, there's no room for you in the Magic Kingdom.
Well, okay.
You have to go to
if we're talking
park,
about Disneyland, then yes, you're exactly right.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. So this last one stings the most for me.
Okay.
So they were going to, in Adventureland and Magic Kingdom, build a thrill ride, which is always exciting. You'll hear it called e-ticket rides, which we can go into that on a different date. Okay. But it was basically the best kind of ride you can have. And it was going to be a hybrid roller coaster train ride where it would be based on Preston Whitmore, which is like his grandpa's rich eccentric friend.
Yeah.
And Preston Whitmore would be 2 years after the movie takes place, and he would be saying, hey, I'm starting this thing where I'm sending people to Atlantis, and like every classic theme park ride, you'd start your journey and things would go awry, and
yeah.
you'd travel around kind of mimicking the journey that Milo and his team went on. And it was going to...
That sounds like so much fun.
It was
going
to be very cool. Yeah. Oh, so that one hurts the most.
Yeah, that does hurt.
Now, if you're like me and you're in a deep funk from thinking about what could have been, there is still a way where you can go to a Disney park and you can go to Volcania and you can visit Atlantis, but you have to go to Tokyo.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So this is third humble brag. Well, no, second humble brag. Either way. I've been to Tokyo DisneySea a couple times. I will go a million times. It's the best theme park you can go to.
Okay.
And they have this land called Volcania. There's two rides. One is 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, where you're in like these little submarines. You don't actually go underwater. They make you believe you do by putting water in the windows. Either way, you go down to Atlantis, but it's populated by merpeople. So a little different. A little different. It's Atlantis.
This is as close as we're getting. We'll take it.
Yeah. And, you know, the details of the plot is loose because it's in Japanese and I can only be like, squid, mer yeah. people. Either way you live. Yeah. And the second one is called Journey to the Center of the Earth.
Okay.
And that one, I even like before this episode, I Googled, like, did they recycle the rides they were going to build into Tokyo, or did the Tokyo rides fuel this one? Because the Journey to the Center of the Earth plot sounds nearly identical to the ride that they were going to build in Magic Kingdom, where you get in this car and you're going to the center of the earth. Things go wrong, and then suddenly, and you find these demonic bug creatures. It's the most insane ride, and then you shoot out of the volcano.
Oh, yes.
And it's a great ride. So if you any of these things sound great, go to Tokyo.
Okay.
Just go.
So I need to go on a literal, sea adventure across the Pacific Ocean, and then I can get to Tokyo Disney, and then I can go on the fictitious ocean rides. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
That sounds.
Yeah, you can take a fake adventure after your real one.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it is. It makes me happy. It is truly just a whole place where they even have a Nautilus submarine modeled after the Nautiluses that you could see in the original 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea at Magic Kingdom. So it all comes together.
Okay.
So
okay,
that's my third fact: is that some dreams died, but the dream lives on in other ways.
Yeah. Yeah, I still won't forgive them for not, hyping up Atlantis more. You know, a TV show would have been great. I remember distinctly on Disney Channel, the Lilo and Stitch TV show, you know, and he's meeting all of his cousins, like experiment, whatever number and whatnot. Super fun. Atlantis TV show would have been super cool. Would have loved seeing them go to, whatever semi-supernatural place they go to next. That would have been so much fun.
I know. Well, we'll never know. We can dream. But the story does continue. And where? That's in Lorcana.
Yes.
So that's...
That's exactly where Atlantis lives on, because we didn't get to see Atlantis actually in the first two sets, but boy, did we get some cards in Into the Inklands. They made a big debut with 14 cards. So the card breakdown for Atlantis, we got 3 Milo Thatch cards. We have 3 Kida cards. We have 3 Helga Sinclair cards. And then Audrey Ramirez, Joshua Sweet, and our friend Lyle Tiberius Rourke all have 1 card. And then we have 1 action repair, and then 1 item, which is the Heart of Atlantis. And wouldn't you know it, no songs.
There's still a chance that maybe they'll be like, you know that weird song at the ending? What's it called?
But, so you know that R&B song that they play at the end? Why not?
Exactly.
And you know, when a movie debuts in Lorcana, like, you love to see it rolled out like this. I mean, 14 cards all in one set. That feels pretty good. Like, if you're an Atlantis fan, which I know a lot of our friends at the LGS were like, when's Atlantis coming? And then they revealed those first cards and it was like, oh yeah, it's coming. So what are some cards that from Atlantis that really stick out to you, Katie?
You know, this is interesting because it's... I don't want to be like, well, none of them. Because, I mean, technically none of them I run in, like, any of my decks today.
Sure.
I love all the art, though, and the flavor of it. Those are good. So the fact that we got them, I was like, I don't care what they say. But if we are analyzing the merit of the cards, I love a little one drop 2/2. So I'm excited that, you know, I have Akita to draft as my early ramp.
And Milo.
Kind of, that's
and
true.
And a one
yeah,
drop 2/2. So for draft, I mean, we'll take those all day.
Exactly. So I'm glad, you know, they're there. And I like that they put the Atlantean text, which is, you know, as we learned, was a real text on the Kita one drop card.
Yeah, remind me what that says in English. Do you remember?
Welcome to Atlantis.
Yeah, welcome to Atlantis. I'm pretty sure that's what it says.
Yeah. I'm not one of the one people that speak that language, but I'm pretty sure someone else translated it. The other card, so the Kita legendary, I'm terrible. People will read a card and they're like, this one's going to be great. This one's terrible. I can never tell. Whenever I say it's going to be great, everyone's like, no, that's terrible. And vice versa. But the legendary Kita, I was like, I don't get it. And I finally got it because I played against a hyper aggro deck. It was Amethyst Amber or Amber Amethyst.
Yeah.
And it was like turn 5 and they had lots of little guys and I was ready to start punching little guys. And then he played Kita and I was like, oh.
I can't punch the little guys anymore. Yeah.
I know. And they can't punch me. We're all sitting there. But yeah. I mean, there's ways around it. The good news is Steel Song. I had the Evil Queen pump up somebody to punch one of their guys. But
that's one way to do it.
So there is ways around it. But it's a nice tempo. I don't know if that's the right term. But either way, it slowed me down.
Yeah, I'd say it's a tempo card.
So it slowed me down.
It really is because, you know, as you're establishing the board on turns, you know, 1 through 4, if you're playing an aggro deck, you're like, okay, it's time to slow you down. But Kita basically says, and you can't slow me down. You know, like whatever momentum you've built up into turn 5, you just kind of get to carry it all the way through turn 5, which is like, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
So that's a good card.
It is. And it's interesting that, you know, aggro decks are so sensitive to once you wipe their board, there's a chance they'll never come back. So, you know, there's lots of different ways to wipe someone's board. But I did not have those ways. I succumbed to my injuries. But so, yeah, that card, I see now the bigger picture. Plus the Enchanted. It's beautiful. So obviously the Kita cards are my favorite so far. What about you?
Yeah. Well, we talked about that Kita card to some extent in a something that might be coming out later this week. And so, you know, if you really want to hear us gush on that card, you know, tune in a little bit.
Exactly.
One card that I really want to highlight is the legendary Milo. That card, I don't think I've seen that card in a single deck. And, you know, I'll be the first to blame. I haven't tried to build a deck with legendary Milo either. So, you know, I will say that. But I was actually thinking going into, like, reveal season for Into the Inklands, you know, there's just some similarities that I've picked up between different cards. You know, the similarity between like Genie on the job. He's a 6-drop uninkable that bounces a card back to hand. Very similar to like Lady Tremaine and Madame Medusa and Ruby. So there are just some similarities between Ruby and Emerald where Ruby is straight up banishing these characters. Whereas in Emerald, you're bouncing them. You know, you have like Mother Knows Best and Dragonfire or something like that. But I was like, there should be a card that's like Be Prepared in Emerald, but instead of banishing all cards, it returns all cards to hand or something like that. And then like a few days later, this Milo card comes out that's like, when this character is challenged and banished, like all your opponent has to return all their cards to the hand. And I was like, okay, not exactly what I was looking for, but very close. And I don't know. Another card that I feel like might fall a very similar fate to this Milo is the legendary Belle that's in Emerald, where, you know, if you challenge her and banish her, then you have to discard your whole hand. Like, it is very punishing, but it's like, can you actually pull it off? It just seems like there's way too many ways around it with Steel being so rampant. You know, you don't actually have to challenge these characters to banish them. So I don't know. Hopefully those sorts of cards, you know, can see some play at some point.
Yeah, I feel like Emerald has a graveyard of not overhyped, but certainly very hyped cards. Like, I think even Cheshire Cat for a while, people are like, this is going to break the meta, Belle, Milo. And it's like, well, one day, maybe. So I do, yeah. I do hope one day they find their deck, and I won't be that person because I'm not creative, but I hope somebody can find a way to make that work.
Yeah. Yeah. And you talked about the Kida legendary card. It's super cool to see that both Milo and Kida got a legendary. I kind of wanted to bring up the 2-drop Kida bodyguard that has the exact same stat line as the Simba Protective Cub. Very good card. And I just want to ask the question, like, what happened to bodyguards? I feel like I just don't see bodyguards in decks anymore.
Yeah, no. I think the only bodyguard that people play that I've seen is that I don't want to say stupid blue, but stupid blue that like,
in an aggro deck,
you have to go through me.
And maybe, yeah,
no,
sometimes the prince and, but you know, we got some good bodyguards into the Inklands, like Joshua Sweet from Atlanta, goodness gracious, got the challenge event on my mind from Atlantis, 5-drop bodyguard with 2 lore. Great card. We also got Nani from Lilo and Stitch bodyguard. We got the big Pluto bodyguard, but like, these cards just aren't getting to see a whole lot of limelight, which is, you know, a bit of a bummer, I'd say.
It is, yeah. They're like, you don't need bodyguard when Lady Train's coming for you, I guess.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
Yeah, again, with so much steel where you can just bypass the bodyguard and choose whatever you want with your Along Came Zeus, you know, or you can choose whatever you want with your Madame Medusa, bodyguard just, you know, one's challenging. We really just need to get a challenging engine built so that challenging matters more, because bodyguard is obvious, you know, bodyguard and evasive are just like the direct counters to challenging. And it's like Maui is the only card that's challenging anybody, you know,
and he's challenging everyone, unfortunately.
Yeah, exactly. And the last card that I want to bring up, is Audrey Ramirez. You know, I'm a Ruby Sapphire player. This is a Sapphire card, 5-drop inkable, 2/5 stat line. She has Ward, which I think is very important. I think Ward is a very underappreciated keyword right now. And her ability, Spare Parts. Whenever this character quests, ready one of your items. So as someone who has been all in on the Lucky Dime, you know, I've really been trying to find out a way that I could squeeze in like 1 or 2 Audrey Ramirez's into my Ruby Sapphire deck so I can double tap Dime on Audrey or on Gaston or on Belle or on Tamatoa, something like that. I mean, you could go from 8 lore to a win with Audrey Ramirez, you know, in no time. So
I hate that Dime. So no, the Dime has hurt me many times the past 2 weeks. So, but no, that's a good idea because, the Dime just comes in and it's like, oh, I don't need to wait to dry, for I have a Dime to quest, and it's like, oh. So it's a very annoying card, but it is great. So
yeah. So it does add an extra card to, you know, some of these combos for Sapphire. But man, if you have a Dime down, you use your Dime, you quest with Audrey, you get to use your Dime a second time on the same turn. Like that's pretty powerful. So
yeah,
I don't know. Good card to highlight, I think. You know, now, as we said, there really is an ensemble of a cast for Atlantis, and plenty of other like things to consider about the world of Atlantis. So Katie, what are some cards that you'd like to see, from this universe?
Yeah, so, you know, it's tricky because, you know, some of the characters I'm like that weren't included, you know, is there a Cookie fan out there? I don't know. But if there is, I think it would be fun to have a Cookie where your characters, like when it comes into play, he feeds your characters or your opponent's characters and they have a stomach ache and they can't quest for the next turn. Like, I thought that would be kind of fun. Where Cookie is, you know, I don't know what color that would be. Maybe steel. I don't know. Who knows? Green. Green is always the one that
the tricky one.
So maybe green. Yeah. So that was the first one I was thinking that. Yeah, that would be a good idea.
Yeah.
The other one I thought that would be fun. So, Magic the Gathering has something called tokens, where some creatures can kind of create tokens, which are like not really a card you put in your deck, but something that is a result of a card in your deck.
Okay.
So I thought it'd be fun to have an object be like the lantern in the cave. And then once you sacrifice that, it creates like 5/1/1 tokens. And then it's all those little fireflies that swarm.
Oh. That could be fun.
Like an item that turns into little guys.
Yeah.
So, but they haven't done token. That'd be new. It'd be crazy, but that is an idea.
Hey.
And then my last two notes. Joshua Sweet needs to be a healer.
Yes.
I want a healer, a Joshua Sweet card. Or a bone saw. He could be, you know, he could use his bone saw.
Yeah, we could have like a Dreamborn version where he's like a wrestler or something.
Yeah. And then the very last one I had was, I love the Floodborn because then you can do things that didn't happen in the movie.
Yeah.
So I thought it'd be cool if Milo was consumed by the crystal. So instead of Kida or Lyle, as I call him, maybe he could activate, like, either once he is comboed with an item that's a crystal or he does something.
Yeah.
And then he can, like, challenge ready creatures or characters and something like that. I think that could be fun if he went into sicko mode like Lyle did at the end of the film.
Yeah. So,
those are mine. What about you?
That's a great idea. Now that you bring up that, you know, sicko mode Lyle, he should definitely be like a, we need like a Ruby Lyle that has Reckless. You know, he could be like extremely fragile. Like he could be like a five drop that hits for like eight, but he has like one or two willpower or something like that. And has Reckless. Yeah. That would be kind of interesting. You know, a few characters that I think are, you know, kind of get slept on. Vinny, I think that guy's hilarious, with the, you know, his family runs the flower shop. Pretty cool. I could see him being in Ruby since he's like the you know, we talked about explosions earlier. He could like remove locations somehow. He could like kind of like Wildcat from this set where you exert him to banish an item. Like maybe Vinny also has evasive or something and you could, exert him to banish a location, or like, he kind of has like grab your swords, but it's also kind of like Teeth and Ambitions where it deals 2 damage to everybody on the field, like your characters and your opponent's characters. So it's like he set off some dynamite and like everybody's affected by it or something.
Yeah, that's very cool because, yeah, he's blowing everything up.
Yeah, he's just blowing stuff up over there. So, you know, less songs, more explosions, as Vinny always said. You mentioned Preston Whitmore, the guy who actually like funds the whole trip. I had heard someone say something that I think Lorcana will roll out at some point, and that's actually using your lore as a resource. And so because he's like super rich, it's kind of like, what if Preston Whitmore allows you to like, you can, you know, lose 1 lore to draw 2 cards or something like that. Like he could be in Sapphire or, you know, like you lose a lore and then take 2 cards off the top of your deck and put them in your Inkwell face down and exerted or something like that. Like you can use your lore to draw some cards or get some ink or something like that.
You know, what'd be cool that they haven't done is if you could sacrifice your ink to gain lore, because there's sometimes like, you're like, I mean, gosh, when you play a Sapphire and they're like, I have 32 ink. So if you got to the point where you're like, oh, I only need 2 more lore to close out this game.
Yeah.
But I don't know. That'd be too broken. I wouldn't like that actually. So don't do that. Yeah. Anybody that just,
it's all
me,
about the conversion rate, right? It's like, am I really going to sacrifice 4 ink for 1 lore or something like that? You know, but if it was like 1 for 1, then it's like, oh, that's busted. You know, as soon as you get to 12, you can just sack all 12 ink and win, you know? But I don't know. There's something there that could really mix up the game, you know? Kind of alternative to that, I thought an item of the Shepherd's Journal. There could be a lot of options for this, but I kind of kept it in the, you know, Whitmore is the one that finds the Shepherd's Journal to give to Milo, and so it could kind of like have some synergy with Whitmore, where if Whitmore is sacrificing lore to draw cards or to ramp, then maybe the Shepherd's Journal is going in the opposite direction, like you discard cards or you somehow sacrifice your ink so that you can get lore back. You know, similar to what you were actually just saying, but you know, the Shepherd's Journal I think could be a pretty powerful item. And then Atlantis as a location, you know, I feel like that's we should see that at some point. Probably in Amber. Yeah. I'd want to see it probably similar to like Pride Lands, where it gives you extra willpower so you can stay alive longer, but maybe it heals instead of reducing character cost, or maybe similar to Kida's ability, like every time somebody challenges one of your characters at this location, their strength is reduced by like 1 or 2 or something like that. So something like that.
There's so much we could do.
Yes.
So, well, this movie is a bittersweet window into a world where Disney had a very different start to the millennium with a focus on vintage action and adventure. But even though we only had a short voyage with Milo, Kida, and the crew, it was one that left a lasting impression. And I'm glad to see that the story is alive through Disney Lorcana, yes, as we have seen today. So for our audience, are you a fellow lover of this forgotten classic? Or did you never forget it? What characters or locations are you hoping to see represented going forward? So as always, make sure to tell us on Twitter, Instagram. We'd love to hear your take. So definitely let us know.
Yeah. Now, in addition to your responses to today's episode, each week we like to turn the mic to you, our listeners, to see what questions you have about Disney and the world of Lorcana. This week, we have a question from Rebecca that reads, do you have any advice for someone new to deck building? So, Katie, you and I have dabbled a little in some deck building. So, like, what are some things that you keep in mind when you go into building a deck?
Yeah, and I think our answers are going to be a little bit different in the sense that I am a little less of a technical Lorcana player. If I have any brain tokens to hand out to my hobbies, I usually will put it towards the playing, not the gripping.
Fair enough.
So my strategy for deck building is I love a good meta deck, and I use the meta deck as a starting place. So I like to pick a deck that I like based on the colors I like. And you really can only know that through experience. You never know what you like to play until you play it, unfortunately or fortunately. So basically, I'll look at the meta. Like, and by meta, I mean go to Reddit or some kind of social media site and look at previous competitions and look at ones that I think are fun. I mean, honestly, the reason I became a Steel Song player is I'm like, that deck has Stitch and Lilo. So it doesn't have to be super scientific. Sure. You pick something you like and then use that as a starting point. So I will just tweak based on things that have burned me. Like, for example, there's cards where you will say, this didn't work, and now I'm going to change this one card, and hopefully I can prevent that in the future. Like, for example, you might run into 1,000 McDuck Manors and be like, well, this deck needs Rise of the Titans. And you just slowly tweak it until eventually it is your deck list. It is a meta deck in the sense that it's an archetype that someone's going to recognize, but you built it based on what you like. So that's the lazy man's way of deck building. Caleb, how do you do it?
Yeah. Well, net decking, you know, which is looking up somebody else's deck and then using it or tweaking it, like, I'm all for it. If you want a homebrew, if you want a net deck, like, I'm two thumbs way, way up on in all directions. But from a homebrew perspective, like, if you don't want a net deck, there's kind of like three or four things that I keep in mind when I'm doing that. First, you have to start with an essential idea. So there are some cards that are like build around cards or cards that's like, okay, obviously based on the keywords or whatever is on the card, clearly the developers wanted these cards to work together. So a really good build around card we've talked about a little bit is Rockstar Stitch, right? So he really synergizes off of lots of 1 and 2 drop characters. So, you know, you could build around Rockstar Stitch. With my double feature decks, you know, I really have to do this because there's really no like net decking I can do for it. So I have to kind of think of like, okay, if I want to do Simba and Beast for my double feature deck, like that's my essential idea. I kind of start with the two movies that I start with or whatever. The next thing you want to do, there's kind of like two things. I think both of these are very important, but I think actually counterintuitively, one is more important than the other. You need to come up with a draw engine and you need to figure out what your win condition is. And actually, I think the draw engine is more important than the win condition because at the end of the day, all characters except for characters with Reckless and then maybe like a few others, you know, like there's that Magicka Dispel Sapphire or Amethyst card that doesn't have any lore on her, but like 98% of characters have lore on them. And so as long as you're playing characters, you can quest with them to get to 20 lore, but it not all cards allow you to draw other cards. So you need to figure out, okay, I know my ink combo, I kind of know my build around cards, but how am I going to draw more cards? Because the cards that come out of your hand are used for ink and cards that you play. So it's not like you're going to run out of cards quick if you don't have a way to draw cards. And there are a lot of different ways to draw cards. I think we'll see even more draw engines be developed over time. But, you know, are you going to go with Amethyst, which has the most straightforward draw engine? Do you want to use a whole new world in Steel? Do you want to use Prince John in Emerald and make your opponent discard cards so that you can draw cards? Do you want to use Amber, which, you know, has like Rapunzel and Surfer Stitch that, you know, you might have to have other characters out or you might have to heal things in order to draw, things like that. So figure out how you're going to draw and then, you know, kind of figure out your win condition. Are you going to quest to win or are you going to do bounce shenanigans with Goat or are you going to use items like Lucky Dime or Spellbook to try to get across the finish line? You know, those are things to consider. And then once you've kind of figured those things out, then lastly, you fill out your curve and you check your uninkable count. Make sure your uninkables are manageable. Make sure you have cards that you can play on every turn and that your curve is well rounded out. So, you know, that's like a good place to start. I know that's like pretty abstract. It's a lot easier to see it in action when somebody's actually doing it, but those are some things to keep in mind.
And also a great idea for a bonus episode because Ooh, this is you could teach college classes on this kind of thing. Because
deck building 101.
Yeah, you know, when we talk about win condition. Yeah, because I mean, and I think that's my like last thing I'll say is you also have to remember what are you building this deck for? Because that's why I think casual league nights can be fun because deck building is a lot more fun when the stakes are lower because people, I like to win. Most people like to win. So deck building can be punishing because you're like, I always lose. And that's because everybody else is playing a deck where science, it's built by science. So if you want to have the best of both worlds, I would look into things like Caleb mentioned, double feature, other things that your league can do where it encourages people to build decks, you get creative and you're not playing a completely different game than everybody else with their meta decks.
Yeah.
So that's my
And this is kind of counterintuitive, but actually the more constraints you put on yourself, the more fun you can have with your deck building. So like for double feature, like I've talked about, it's two inks, it's 60 cards. So the same exact like deck building restrictions that are normally there, but I add the extra condition of only two movies. And it's actually that extra condition that opens up deck building and makes it more fun. Another popular one to do is like Porcana or Street Rat or whatever you want to call it, where you restrict yourself to only using common and uncommon cards. If you put extra restrictions on yourself, you actually start playing with cards that you wouldn't otherwise play with, and you can actually have more fun that way, especially if you're playing against another deck that has the same restrictions on it. Then you know, if you're going to play a meta deck with your Porcana deck, like that's not going to be a good time. But Katie, if you and I play with only commons and uncommons, like it's going to be a lot of fun. So
there's a deck for every occasion.
Yeah.
So I think that's a fun question. So we definitely want to do more content on that, on other ways to play those formats, the benefits. I mean, another great resource if you like building decks on the fly, Unlimited, 40born, Jake and his podcast is a great way to kind of listen to different ways to use cards. So that's the most fun part about Lurkana is there's a billion, not a billion, that's too many, but several ways to play. It's just what you like most. So, Rebecca, thank you for your question. And if you, the listener, would like to have your question answered, please feel free to email us at questions@HakunaLurkanaPod.com or reach out to us on Twitter @HakunaLurkana. And if your question is selected, we will send you an exclusive Hakuna Lurkana sticker for you to show off to all your friends at League. And recently I found out they you can put it on a car, you can put it on a water bottle. These are good stickers.
Yeah.
I don't want to brag.
You can put them anywhere.
They're good. I know. So
yeah,
that could be yours.
It could be yours.
Send us an email. I love answering questions.
Send us a question. Yep.
Exactly.
And if you enjoyed spending time with us today, please feel free to leave us a review on your podcasting platform of choice. We really do appreciate the support our listeners provide to us. And next week, we will be taking a softer type of journey as we head to the 100-acre woods to cover two movies this time. First, the 1977 movie, The Many Adventures of Winnie the Pooh, and the 2011 movie, Winnie the Pooh. So that should be fun. We get to kind of 2-for-1 on that one. I'm looking forward to it. And as always, thank you for hanging out with us today. And until next time, Hakuna Lurkana means no words.